car out.
You knew?
Suspected. The flash drive wasn't where you put it. We've seen how these guys operate. I connected the flags.
So maybe I'm not being paranoid about that van, then?
What van?
The one that's been parked right across the street ever since I got home.
What's the reg? He rattled it off. Don't worry, that's Max's friend.
I'm sorry, what?
Guy who's watching out for you.
Mac!
Look, you may be big, but that doesn't mean you can defend yourself against these people. What was I supposed to do?
You're unbelievable.
Thank you. He made a growling noise. You know, this could work for us, I said, an idea coming to me.
You feeling all right?
Zip it and listen. The cops will be taking this seriously. It's attempted homicide. There'll be CCTV footage of the accident. Marylebone Road is a dual carriageway and a main route into the city. There'll be cameras covering every inch of it. Whoever's behind this will have been following you. He'll also have approached your car after you crashed. He had to. He needed to get the flash drive. Which means he will have been snapped. His face is going to lead us to the heart of this Fugazi operation, and a photo buried in Trent Park's going to seal the deal. Chapter 131. Briefing Room, Scotland Yard, 1830. We were all seated round the table for the evening briefing. It had started later than usual. None of us would be making it home in time for dinner, not with a killer on the prowl. Everyone was now up to speed about the buried bag of clothes.
We'll get officers over to the site now, the DI said when I'd finished. And in other news, ANPR shows a BMW registered to the Harpers in Clerkenwell on the nights of both murders. We also have Sarah's phone pinging off a mast in Farringdon Street on the dates and times in question, which places her near the abduction sites. Plus CCTV shows the Bimmer driving round the city. The resolution's not great, but our resident tech geniuses were able to zoom in. They've got an image of a dark-haired woman behind the wheel. Her features aren't that clear, but I don't think the CPS will have any trouble persuading a jury it's Harper's wife. Now we've just got to find her before she attacks again.
And we were no closer to that than when we'd first brought Harper in.
Shall I have another pop at Harper?
Said Silk, with all the bright-eyed enthusiasm of a first weeker.
No point. Mackenzie's taken that side of things as far as we can.
Silk shot me a look. It wasn't friendly.
So basically, we're screwed, said Ruddock. You might want to adjust that attitude. It hasn't even been 24 hours yet,
said Isakson, his voice snappish, the pressure starting to show.
It's not far off, though,
Big Daddy whispered loudly to Frost.
Perhaps you'd like to join Ruddock on a PMA course, Shapiro. They run them every Sunday, I believe. Now, if you're ready to settle down, I'll tell you what we're doing about finding her. We've put out an APW, so if she tries to flee the country, we'll know about it. And I've got tech monitoring the forum, ready to trace an IP address if she posts, and given how dependent she seems to be on the network for support, it's possible she will. Her mobile's still off, so we haven't been able to get a trace on that yet, but as soon as she turns it on, we'll be able to pinpoint her whereabouts. In the meantime, I'm going to be releasing Sarah's picture to the media, along with a statement asking the public to keep a lookout and call it in if they think they've spotted her. In other words, turning them into our eyes and ears. Given the level of interest in the case, we should see some results. We'll need to be prepared for false sightings. That comes with the territory. But it's our best chance of finding her.
Actually, I have a better idea, I said. Isakson glanced over with a scowl. If it works, Sarah Harper will be in custody by tomorrow night.
She's a mind reader, don't you know? Said Ruddock, with a manky-toothed grin, looking round the room for appreciation.
Oxygen thief.
Go on, Mackenzie, said Isakson, looking like he wanted to give Pimples a swift nut punch.
We need to use a proactive technique to flush her out.
English, please.
My mate Ruddock again. We don't need to look for her. We'll get her to come to us, which means not making it known we're onto her.
Go on.
We'll stage a candlelight vigil for Pejman and Abian in Primrose Hill tomorrow night. It needs to be well publicised, and the families should attend. Sarah Harper will be drawn to the event. She'll seek out the bereaved relatives to offer her condolences. She'll feel an affinity with them, since she thinks she was nearly the slasher's third victim. Remember, we know what she's capable of, but to her, she's the one in danger. For it to work, we have to release a statement saying we've charged Dan Harper. Sarah's following the news carefully. The way she sees it, her life depends on it. Only when her husband's behind bars will she feel safe enough to come out of hiding.
You want us to lie to the media? Said Silk.
He looked appalled.
Aye. Can we do that?
He said, turning to Isakson. The DI beat me to it.
If it helps us collar a killer, then yes. Absolutely we can lie.
So speaketh the man who hates the press. Sunday. Chapter 132. Primrose Hill, London, 1946.
Go home, kiss your kids and tell them you love them, because life's too short.
Yasmin Pejman's mother was down from Leeds, addressing the hordes that had flocked to Primrose Hill for the vigil. There must have been hundreds of people there, all standing arm in arm, hugging each other and weeping for women most of them had never met. The darkness was punctuated with spots of light. Candles and lighters held up to the sky, the flames shielded from the biting wind, and bobbing among them were the pink balloons the families had handed out at the start. The press hounds were licking their chops, capturing it all with wide-angled lenses. By the time the papers hit the stands, the vigil would be on every front page. Yasmin's son was holding his father's hand, staring hard at the ground. His lip wobbled. He was trying not to cry. Watching him set off a reaction in me. The night Duncan was shot, I'd told him I was pregnant. I'd just come off a course of antibiotics. It never occurred to me they might interfere with the pill. I couldn't believe it when my period was late. Motherhood had never been big on my agenda. But when I showed Duncan the clear blue stick and his mouth cracked into a smile that could have swallowed me whole, everything changed. Suddenly, having his child was what I wanted more than anything.
Let's go to Don Giovanni's for dinner, he'd said,
to celebrate. 2 hours later, he was lying dead on the pavement, a hole in his head. A day after that, I started to bleed. A drop of icy water splashed on my face. I glanced up. The sky was gun barrel black. Rain was on the way. I noticed Isakson turn up his collar, scanning the crowd. We'd been here for 2 hours, watching, waiting. But there was still no sign of Sarah Harper. There were 30 undercover officers with earpieces stationed around the perimeter and every exit, all saying the same thing. We should have got her by now. Why haven't we? This wasn't just our best chance of netting the killer. If we didn't make an arrest tonight, we could have another victim by morning.
Yasmin and Lily's lives were cut short before their time. We're all at a loss for words. Every day, my grandson has to wake up without his mummy. How do you explain that to a child? How do you tell him that everything's going to be okay when you don't believe it yourself? Nothing will bring our girls back to us, but we want to express our gratitude to the Scotland Yard detectives who've worked tirelessly to find the man responsible and bring him to justice.
I thought you said she'd be here,
Isakson hissed in my ear. She is, I said, with more conviction than I felt. Had I screwed up? Could I really be so sure Sarah Harper would show her face? I was the one who'd pushed for this. The cost, the time wasted, it had come back to bite me in the arse if the operation went south.
We love you, Yasmin and Lily,
Pejman's mother said, her voice booming as she moved into the microphone.
"We love you," echoed the crowd, releasing their balloons into the air. Someone started singing "Wind Beneath My Wings." It caught on fast. My eyes darted over the throng.
"Damn it, where are you, Sarah? Why hadn't she approached the grieving relatives?"
She saw herself as one of the victims. Talking to them, associating herself with their loss, would be a way of getting comfort for herself. So why hadn't she? The service wound up. People began to drift off. "Come on, Zeba, think." I closed my eyes, putting myself in her boots. "I'm Sarah. I think my husband's a serial killer, and that I narrowly avoided becoming his next victim. I'm at the vigil. What do I do?" My eyes shot open. I started running, shouting into my mouthpiece as I went. "She'll be by the bouquets. Approach with caution. Do not spook her." It was dark, the throng still thick enough to stop me seeing clearly up ahead, but I had no doubt now where she'd be. Sarah Harper might be responsible for their deaths, but that didn't stop her identifying with the victims. In her mind, the makeshift shrine was for her too. "Move, make a hole," I shouted, pushing people aside as I closed in on the spot. And there she was. A small, dark-haired woman crouching by the flowers that had been left for Pejman and Abian. Only she wasn't leaving a bouquet. She was reading the cards, as if they were addressed to her.
"I see I female by the railings, duffel coat and jeans. I'm moving in."
I recognized her then. She was the woman who'd approached me outside the yard the day I thought I was being followed. And very possibly, it had been her zigzagging along the street, tired and emotional, as I'd left the crime scene on Wednesday morning. Now we had our Cinderella. The footmarks the CSIs found at the scene would confirm it. I approached her slowly. We could do without her bolting again. Behind me, the team closed in. "Sarah," I said, putting my hand on her shoulder. She jerked round, her eyes wide like those of a penned-in animal, and for a moment the surprise was mutual. Because clothes aside, I could have been staring at my own reflection. 3 weeks later. Chapter 133. Scotland Yard, London, 1558. I took a sip of lukewarm coffee, made a face, and checked my watch again. How much longer? The strip lights buzzed and flickered. The heating was on high. I mashed my forehead with the heel of my hand. I could feel a migraine coming on, building up behind my eyes. Just what I didn't need. 3 weeks had passed since Sarah Harper's arrest. She'd pleaded guilty to 2 counts of murder and was now being treated in the newly opened paddock unit at Broadmoor, a high-security psych facility in Berkshire, set up specifically to help patients considered to pose a grave and immediate danger to the public and diagnosed as having a dangerous and severe personality disorder. Dan Harper had managed to avoid a trial, but he'd been struck off the roll. He'd never practice law again. In many ways, he'd got off lightly. Although he'd been cooperative at the end, Lily Abian would still be alive if he'd spoken up sooner, and Tristan Fontaine would have been spared the distress of being fingered for a crime he didn't commit. Harper had been frightened for his wife, and no doubt for himself too. But instead of facing up to that fear, he'd pulled the duvet up over his head and hoped the monsters would just go away. The last few weeks have taught me that never happens. The only way to vanquish your demons is by facing them head on with a BFG. A big fucking gun. Or a Polaroid, I mused, thinking about the Trent Park photo back at my flat that Jack and I had dug up the day after Sarah Harper was arrested. Even now, after all the time that had passed, it still made uncomfortable viewing. A morbidly obese man with a sack of flesh under his chin and a globe-shaped stomach grinning for the camera, his arms round the waists of 2 skinny, bare-chested boys wearing tiaras and ballerina tutus. Well, he won't be grinning now, I thought, glancing at the closed door to my left, the hum of raised voices pulsing through the walls.
I'd just chucked my coffee away and was wondering whether I had time to nip to Starbucks for a fresh one, when the door opened and a grey-faced man in a wrinkled suit came out.
He's all yours.
Finally. I took a breath, straightened my jacket and pushed down on the handle. It was the same suite I'd interviewed Dan Harper in 3 weeks ago. But this time I didn't knock. Chapter 134. The bullets were finally slotting into place. I knew that once one victim started talking, more would come forward, and with tangible proof of what Craig Bowden had told me, Wolfie had enough to persuade his editor to allow him to run an initial story. The guy had pushed back to begin with, though. "I spelled out the consequences if we sat on this," Jack had said at the time, "but he's pissing himself about lawsuits."
"What are you going to do?"
"Persuade him," Jack had said. "I'm not walking away from this. It's not just about Duncan anymore."
I'd nodded. He was right. We'd started out wanting to get justice for my husband. Now it was also about the countless children whose lives had been destroyed and about protecting those still at risk. When the police arrested the rat fuck who'd tried to kill Jack and found the missing flash drive at his digs, his editor gave the go-ahead for a first article, and things upped a gear from there. Duncan used to say, the only way three people can keep a secret is if two of them are dead. In my world, one was usually enough, but the point still stands. And in this case, too many people knew something. After the first article was published, a former child protection officer got in touch with Jack.
"I've long suspected a campaign of abuse," he said, "but there's always been a conspiracy to stop the truth getting out."
NSPCC research confirmed what he said. According to their records, over the last 20 years there had been at least 500 reports of abuse at children's homes spanning 14 different establishments. And then we came up with the clincher. A whistleblower claimed the Home Office had indirectly funded the Paedophile Information Exchange, PI, a FUBAR organisation from the 1970s that openly campaigned for the age of consent to be lowered to 4. Apparently, the deputy leader of the Labour Party had been the legal secretary for a pressure group affiliated with PI, and the organisation itself was run for almost 4 years from a small room inside Whitehall. I tracked down a copy of a book in the British Library, containing a series of Fugazi articles arguing why child sex should be legalised. "Why are people so quick to defend a child's right to say no to sex while conveniently ignoring their right to say yes?" the editor wrote in the introduction. I've seen some pretty bad stuff over the years. I know firsthand what human beings are capable of doing to each other. But this book really turned my stomach. These perverts were every bit as screwed up as the serial killers I helped put away. It took me till the end of the book to find what I needed, though. A biographical essay written by the sicko who'd been PI's chairman from 1979.
"The PI had an office in Westminster," he said, "just feet away from the Home Secretary's desk."
Yet more evidence that a paedophile ring was functioning at the heart of the political establishment. We had everything we needed. Jack and I handed over a dossier of our findings to the Independent Police Complaints Commission. The story took off, and I persuaded my local MP to raise a question in the House. But although a torch had finally been shone on sunlight, the person who'd ordered Duncan's murder remained a mystery. Though hopefully, not for much longer. I entered the interview room. A man was sitting hunched over the table, the laces removed from his oxfords. Kurt Watkiss. Now it was my turn to go on the attack. Chapter 135. When the police nicked Jack's assailant, I'd really thought Duncan's killer had finally been caught and I might get some closure. But as soon as I'd learned the details of the arrest, I realised we were looking at two different perps. Whoever fired the gun that killed my husband was a master, according to the profile I'd developed at the time of his homicide. A white male in his late 30s, ex-military, with a dishonourable discharge, just like Handler's killer, but also highly organised with excellent attention to detail. From what I found out from the investigating officers at the time, it was likely he'd have worn latex rather than leather gloves to ensure no prints of any kind were left on his weapon, and a surgical mask to prevent the inhalation of GSR, which he'd know can be detected in nasal mucus up to 24 hours after a shooting. There would have been no loose ends. A man like that would never have left the end of a syringe needle visible in Jack's brake hole. He wouldn't have been following Wolfie in a car registered in his own name. And he certainly wouldn't have kept the flash drive in his flat for any length of time. The man who tried to do Jack in was 50 plus, with a nicotine habit, poor hygiene, and no military background. It showed Sunlight's fingers were longer than I'd thought. There wasn't just one shooter on its books, and Duncan's assailant was still out there. I didn't know who he was any more than I knew who'd ordered the hit. However, Kurt Watkiss might. I wasn't sure where he fitted into the Sunlight hierarchy, but his likely involvement in Gavin Handler's murder and its subsequent cover-up gave me a pretty good idea of the sort of operations he was part of. And it's possible he was even the person who'd made the call about Duncan. For the last few weeks, I'd been tearing myself into bits, one eye on the serial killer case, the other on Sunlight, crucifying myself with guilt that I wasn't giving either my full attention. But now I had a sole focus: to get Watkiss talking. I've done a fair bit of interrogating in my time. Hell, I could probably recite the Reed technique under anaesthetic. However, although I've been in plenty of high-stakes situations, this was the first time it was personal. I decided to go in with a carrot. "You're in a lot of trouble, Watkiss. This isn't going away. But if you tell me what I want to know, I can help you. Here's the deal. A Category B prison of your choice, and a reduced sentence if you answer my questions." He leaned across the table, close enough for me to feel the spit on my face when he spoke. "You have no right to interrogate me." "Why? You worried what I might find out?" He sat back, sneering. "You murdered my husband because he was sniffing too close to your dirty little secret. Was it worth it?" "I didn't murder your husband." He clenched his fist. "Semantics, you ordered the hit, just like you did with Handler. It's what we call form, Watkiss. But then you'd know that, being a cop. Just like you knew how to kick the dirt over your tracks."
"I realise this has been a difficult time for you, Mrs. McKenzie, and I'm very sorry for your loss."
"Patronising prick."
"But I didn't have anything to do with your husband's murder. Or Handler's," he added quickly.
I narrowed my eyes.
"I'm willing to help you, Kurt, but you're going to have to do better than that." "I had nothing to do with Duncan's death."
"But you know who did." He put a hand on his not insubstantial stomach and leaned forward again.
"I'm telling you, I don't know who killed Duncan."
I leaned forward too, so we were glaring at each other, our noses inches apart across the table. "The thing you need to know about me, Kurt, is once I set my mind to something, I don't give up. And when a cover-up's as big as Sunlight, mistakes get made. I'm going to find out who pulled that trigger and who ordered the hit. The question is, are you going to help me, or would you rather get buried in the muck with the rest of the worms?"
"You can ask me any which way you want, but my answer isn't going to change. I don't know anything about your husband's homicide," he said, licking his lips. "Might I have a glass of water? It's terribly hot in here."
I slammed my fist hard into the table. "Stop dicking me around, Watkiss. Who killed Duncan?"
"I told you, I don't know."
"I can protect you, just tell me the truth."
"I don't know anything."
I grabbed him by the collar. "Listen here, you lying piece of shit." The door burst open. Two men rushed in, staving off an assault charge. One was the grey-faced bloke from before, the other easily 20 years his senior.
"That's enough, Mackenzie," the older one said, pulling me off. "You need to leave. Now."
Chapter 136. Bloomfield Villas, London, 2156. Jack sighed and slumped back against the sofa. The TV was on low in the background. We were waiting for the news to come on.
"So you got nothing out of Watkiss then?"
"I didn't say that." He gave me a quizzical look.
"You've just been telling me all he'd say was he didn't kill Duncan, and how the Bulldogs had to yank you off him. Not that I'm criticising, mind. If I'd been stuck in there with that schmuck... Well, let's just say, I think you were pretty restrained under the circumstances."
"You've got it wrong, Wolfie. Don't you see? I was playing him. I wanted him to think I'd lost my shit, that I was clueless. That way, he won't go warning anyone I'm coming after them."
"I'm missing something."
He crumpled his face.
"I don't see how we're any the wiser about what happened to Dunk."
"Well, for starters, we now know Watkiss didn't order the hit, but that he knows who did."
"How do you figure that?"
I smiled. "I told you, I was manipulating him, asking him questions and watching his reactions, letting his non-verbals do the talking. When he told me he hadn't been behind the homicide, he was animated, clenching his fist, that sort of thing. Shows he was telling the truth. But when he said he didn't know anything about the murder, his body language changed. His blink rate increased and his mouth went dry. It's why he asked for a drink. Both things are signs of lying."
"Didn't you say you offered him a deal if he gave you a name?"
"I?"
"So why not take it if he had the info? Coppers don't fare well in jail. He'd know that as well as anyone. A reduction in his sentence has got to be worth grassing up whoever he's covering for."
"Precisely." I smiled again.
"I know that look, but I don't get where you're going with this."
"If he didn't take the deal, it's because he's more worried about what'll happen to him if he talks than if he gets banged up."
"Yes,"
he said, stretching the word out, still not understanding. "There are two reasons he'd be scared of giving up whoever this is. First, we're talking about someone with serious clout. Someone who'd be in a position to make Watkiss deeply regret ratting him out. And second, he hasn't been caught yet." Chapter 137. The BBC news graphics flashed across the television screen as the trademark music filled the room. Claims that the political establishment covered up a paedophile ring are being investigated decades after rumours first surfaced. There could be more, the Prime Minister has been warned, as yet another member of the government resigns over the sex scandal. And police have raided the homes of Scotland Yard Detective Inspector Kurt Watkiss and the former Home Secretary, Albert Jones. He hadn't been charged yet. But what Craig Bowden had implied about the old Home Secretary burying the file of names the MP handed him had given the investigating officers cause to look into him further. According to Jack's sources, his arrest was imminent. Following an expose by a Daily Telegraph journalist, an investigation has been launched to look into allegations of a high-level child sex ring run by prominent politicians and members of the establishment that may have been operating for 20 years or more. "You did it," I said to Jack with a grin.
"We did it," he said, smiling back. "You were right, Mac. No one's untouchable."
The allegations centre on Avon Guesthouse in North London. They include claims that children from nearby residential homes were brought there for orgies, where VIPs, including Whitehall officials, cabinet ministers and members of the judiciary, were among the guests. There have been accusations of a cover-up after it emerged that an earlier Scotland Yard inquiry was quashed on orders from superiors and that possible homicides were committed to keep the group's activities secret. We'd come a long way in the last few weeks, but I wasn't finished yet. It would take time for all the Sunlight players to be named, years maybe, and it might take me just as long to find the man I was looking for.
but hurry up and wait is something we were taught early on in the SF. I have a strong bias to action, though I can be patient too. And like I'd said to Watkiss, once I set my mind to something, I don't give up. Jack stretched and got up to leave. His mobile had fallen out of his pocket onto the sofa. The same phone he'd texted me from the morning I was called to the second murder scene. Fear has two meanings. Fuck everything and run, or face everything and rise. The quote may be naff, but that didn't mean it wasn't true. We still hadn't talked about what he'd tried to say to me the evening he landed up in hospital. Despite everything I'd promised myself afterwards, I'd still hidden from my emotions and from his. Enough with the damn running, I thought. I've never been a quitter, and I'm not about to start now. Just before your accident, you wanted to speak to me, I said as we walked out of the living room into the hall. But I fobbed you off. I was tired. I'm sorry. Do you want to talk about it now? My words tumbled out in a rush. I took a breath, my telltale heart beating hard. We were standing in front of the giraffe picture, in the exact same spot as last time, though now I wasn't worried about betraying Duncan. I was worried about myself. Moving on means accepting the past is over. Was I really ready to do that? I looked up at Jack, at his messy hair, unshaven face and kind eyes. Without thinking, I took a step towards him. My body spoke for me. It knew what I wanted.
Oh, that.
He looked embarrassed.
I was offered a job in the States with the Washington Post. I was tempted. I mean, it was an amazing opportunity.
Was. So you're not taking it? My voice was flat. I couldn't help feeling disappointed. This wasn't about him and me then. Had I misread the signs?
He shook his head. I knew you'd push me to go. And like I said, I was tempted. But I couldn't leave you, not with all this going on. And the Sunlight story's only going to get bigger. I need to see it through. There'll be other jobs. Other opportunities.
I nodded, covering my smile. He'd said he couldn't go because of Sunlight, but he'd said he couldn't leave me first. Maybe I hadn't misread the signs after all. I'm glad you're staying.
Me too.
He opened the front door and bent down to give me a hug goodbye. I watched him walk towards the stairs. Halfway, he stopped, turned round and grinned, his hand raised in a wave. I smiled back, a warmth flooding through me, the feeling of waking up after a long sleep. Chapter 138. I was lying in bed, just drifting off, when a thought pulled me back with the full force of a shotgun recoil. Sunlight had been a distraction throughout the Primrose Hill case. I'd got there in the end, but I should have figured out sooner that the killer was a woman. I wasn't sloppy exactly, but I hadn't been at my sharpest either. And I'd just realised that wasn't all I'd missed. Being in the interview room again that afternoon with Watkiss had made me think of the last time I was there with Dan Harper. And now, snatches of conversation I hadn't properly absorbed before was suddenly leaping into focus. I flicked on the bedside lamp and sat up, body flooded with adrenaline, remembering. He'd been rattling off case histories that afternoon.
In 1983, serial rapist Bob Milligan was declared insane and therefore not responsible for his crimes on the basis of his dissociative identity disorder. In 1990, the Crown versus Bartfield, the Court of Appeal overturned a manslaughter conviction on the same grounds.
Harper specialised in mergers and acquisitions, not criminal law. The only way he'd know so much about those cases was if he'd done research. And there was just one reason he'd have done it: if he was already aware of Sarah's condition. I jumped out of bed and started pacing the room, thinking of something else from the interview.
You said it yourself. She suffers from psychogenic fugues. She didn't know what she was doing.
Except that's not what I'd said. I'd called the episodes dissociative, not psychogenic fugues. It was a perfectly valid term, but it wasn't the one I'd used. Fugue states are rare. I'd had to explain them to Isakson, but I didn't need to explain them to Harper. His face didn't change when I made my big reveal, because it wasn't a surprise to him. I thought about how he kept telling me Sarah wasn't well, how he'd supplied the name of her psychiatrist without being asked for it, and the lengths he'd gone to track his wife. That was tech. Seems Harper downloaded a GPS app. He's been monitoring his wife's movements for weeks. Weeks. Plural. In other words, his stalking predated Pejman's murder, which meant... shit. I thought about how he'd locked Sarah in the house and taken away the car keys, and the BMW 3 Series I'd seen as I drove away from the crime scene on Wednesday morning, the same make and model he drives. And what about the photo Sarah found? Harper had been so careful to cover up the affair, the burner, making sure Pejman didn't tell anyone about him, leaving a photo of his lover lying around, just didn't fit with that level of caution and organization. My heart thundered as I nuked it out. Son of a bitch, I thought, grabbing my mobile. I crooked the phone between my shoulder and ear as I tugged on a pair of jeans. Brung, 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 brung. Screw it, I thought, snatching my car keys as the line rang out. That ball bag doesn't get to scare me twice. It may not be protocol, but some things can't wait till morning. Chapter 139. Charlcote Crescent, London, 2358. There's a reason they call it the dead of night. The world wears a shroud. Nothing moves. Apart from the pale fingers of lamplight worming across the rain-soaked streets, Charlcote Crescent was ghost town still. I pressed the bell again, the sharp trill fracturing the quiet, then stepped off the doorstep to check for signs of life inside. He said it was pink, I thought, but he didn't say it was this pink. The townhouse looked like it had been doused in Pepto-Bismol. Even on a road of colourful facades, this one stood out. Not a bad thing, as far as I was concerned. If it had been less conspicuous, I may not have found the place, and with everyone from the tech department over in the land of Nod, locating my target was down to me. I stepped back up to the front door and tried the bell again. This time, it did the trick. Through the small window to the left of the door, I saw the hall light go on, and a moment later it opened a crack. A disheveled figure poked his head out. His hair was mussed and his face smeared with stubble. A 5-day beard, at least. He was so different to when I first met him in the marble foyer at S&M. What would Axel Montan think if he clapped eyes on him now, I thought. Unlikely he'd blush and fumble his words this time. Dan Harper was still built like Captain America, but he also reeked of whiskey and looked like shit. Seeing him like that, alone and broken, I almost felt sorry for him. Almost. My mind went back to the vigil on Primrose Hill 3 weeks ago, to Yasmin Pejman's little boy holding his dad's hand and trying not to cry, to her mother telling a crowd of people to hold their children close, and to the fear in Sarah Harper's eyes as she turned to look at me. No, I didn't feel sorry for Harper, not now I'd worked out what he'd done. He didn't deserve what had happened to him. He deserved what was coming.
Ziba, what are you doing here?
He said, his voice quiet, his knuckles white on the door jamb. I gave him the once-over, eyes wide, jaw slack, pulse going in his temple. He knows, I thought. He knows I know. The game's up. I think you and I'd better have a little chat, Dan, I said. Chapter 140. A look passed over Harper's face, different to the one in the interview room. A tightening round the eyes.
He wasn't ready to stick his hands in the air yet. He moved to slam the door shut, but I got there first, shoving my foot in and pushing it wide. An old journalist trick, courtesy of Wolfie. The hallway was small and dimly lit, a single low-energy bulb. There was a waterproof slung over the banister, a pair of scuffed Reeboks kicked off by the stairs, and an empty vase on the radiator cover. Already the place lacked a woman's touch. Being here without telling anyone at the yard what I was up to was definitely going against procedure, but forcing my way into someone else's house was breaking a whole other set of rules. The law, for one thing. Then again, I've never been much of a Girl Scout, and by the time I'd had a word in Harper's shell-like, I rather doubted he'd be lodging a complaint. I stood with my back against the door, blocking the latch. I didn't want him trying to eject me, not till I'd had a chance to say my piece. It'd be hard to prove to a jury what Harper had done, given the evidence was largely circumstantial. My plan was to get inside his head, persuade him that fessing up was in his best interests, and then accompany him to the yard to make a statement. But the key part of it all was catching him on the hoof in the middle of the night. That way, he'd be tired, easier to manipulate. "You played a good hand," I said, eyeballing him. "You even had me fooled, and not many people can say that. But it's time to fold. We know what you did."
"We?"
He was calling me out. The booze hadn't dulled his senses then. That didn't mean I had to give it to him straight, though. For this to work, he had to believe the team was as tuned in as me, that there was nowhere to run. He looked to the right out of the window, then smiled to himself. What had he seen? I glanced over my shoulder, and as I did, he smashed me round the head with the vase from the radiator. The blow caught me off guard, sending a swell of bile up my esophagus, the glass lashing through my skin. I reeled sideways, clutching my bleeding forehead. How could I have made such a rookie error? Taking my eye off Harper was bad. Underestimating him was worse. But it wasn't over. This guy wasn't just built like Captain America, he also knew how to fight. Taking advantage of my momentary shock and loss of balance, he closed the gap between us, grabbing me by the shoulders and sending his knee into my stomach. I collapsed on the floor, gasping for breath. He was using his body weight against me now, pinning me to the ground, his hands gripping tight round my throat. "There's no we," he said as he squeezed tighter and tighter, making my lungs burn. "You came here on your own, same as the night you had your little rendezvous with Montan." He spat the name out like it left a bad taste in his mouth. "It's what you do. You act alone." So that's why he looked out the window, I thought. He was checking for blues and twos. He wanted to know if I had backup. And now he knows I don't. He's going to finish me off to keep his secret safe. I struggled, helpless against his strength and weight, my body starved of oxygen. "Stop," I said, my voice coming out in a whisper as he released my throat with one hand and began pummeling my face with his fist. "Stop!" I've been trained by the most elite fighters on the planet, but now my body was failing me. Was this it? Was I going to end up as ground meat laid out to rot in the hallway of a Pepto-Bismol pink house? My eyes fluttered. As my attacker's face came closer, my insides froze. He was enjoying this. Exactly what Sarah had written in her forum post. And with that thought, another followed fast. I know how to get out of this. Chapter 141. I mustered the last of my strength, forcing myself to keep my eyes open long enough to connect with his. For this to work, he had to look at my face.
"You're hurting me, Blue Eyes,"
I said, the pet name Sarah used. On their own, the words would have been useless, but from my mouth, they cast a spell. I was the spitting image of Harper's wife, so much so it could have been her talking. His reaction lasted no more than a second, but a second's all I needed. As his hand loosened in surprise, I grabbed his little finger and snapped it back, He screamed as the bone broke, releasing my neck, giving me the chance to put the script right. I gripped the back of his head, using a seesaw motion to pull myself up as I yanked his nut down, smashing my skull into his nose, turning it into a pulp of bloodied flesh and sinew. The human head weighs over 10 pounds. A headbutt's the equivalent of being hit in the face with a gallon tin of paint. It hurts like fuck. Harper was tipping forward, head in both hands, crying out in pain, but I wasn't done yet. His arms were away from his chest. His body was exposed. The hallway was small and narrow. In close-quarter combat, there's one finishing move. I came in, hand on his back, bringing my knee up hard to his groin. Bam. He toppled down, moaning, as he curled into a ball on the previously white marble floor. I was on top of him in an instant, ready to administer a pressure point strike should he try to get up, though, given the state he was in, the only way this guy was going anywhere was on a stretcher. Body shaking with adrenaline, I reached into my jacket pocket and pulled out my mobile. Just a few weeks ago, I'd told Jack I didn't need a hero. But as I punched in the numbers and a drop of blood from the gash on my forehead splashed onto the screen, I realized I'd got it wrong. I'm perfectly capable of looking after myself, but that doesn't mean I should always be so quick to go it alone. And although I'd come out of this fight the victor, if I'd gone into it with a team behind me, I mightn't have made such a mess of my face. 999, what's your emergency?
Zeba McKenzie, Scotland Yard, single crewed, no PPE, violent prisoner, requesting immediate backup.
Harper squirmed. A quick jab to the scapula set him straight. The only place he was going now was jail. Chapter 142. Interview Room 3. Scotland Yard. 0430.
How can this be happening?
Dan Harper thinks, as the detective reads him his rights.
I was so careful.
He and Sarah had been lounging in his dorm room bed, half naked and blowing smoke rings when she'd first told him about her blackouts. Her parents knew she'd had them after her brother's body was found. Trauma-induced, according to the therapist her mother packed her off to. But Dan was the first person to learn the truth. She'd had one before then. The day her brother got murdered in the woods. The golden child, she called him. GC. Sarah had always been crazy jealous of him. The child his parents adored. She kept her feelings hidden, though. No one ever guessed at the dark thoughts in her head. Dan had learned to do the same thing when he was growing up, although his problems had nothing to do with sibling rivalry. With him, it was all about his dad. Nothing he ever did was good enough for his old man, which, oddly enough, always spurred him to try harder to please. Their similar childhood experiences drew him and Sarah together. They were both victims of parental disinterest. No one understood them as well as they understood each other. The day Sarah and GC had gone off to play in the woods, and he'd wound up with his head bashed in, she'd found out he was being sent to a fancy private school in La Jolla, where the kids wore blazers and spent the weekends playing tennis at the country club. Meanwhile, she was being left to rot in the public school system, where she'd been bullied from day one. She said she didn't know what had happened to GC, how he went missing, how he turned up dead. But Dan put a few things together. He was no fool. Plus, he had first-hand experience of what rejection can do to a person. Then, when he'd gone to San Diego to meet his soon-to-be in-laws, the last piece had slotted into place. Sarah's parents had a cocker spaniel, a friendly little thing. It wagged its tail happily at Dan the first time he saw it, even though he wasn't exactly a dog person. But it tried to bite Sarah.
"He hates me," she told him later. "Has done ever since that day in the woods. He was with us. I always wondered what he saw."
Dan couldn't help wondering too. Years later, after Noah died and things hit an all-time low, he took up with Yasmin Pejman. Deep down, Dan wonders if he did it partly to get back at Sarah. His father never approved of the match.
That Iranian girl, he used to call her. It was racist and cruel, but Dan never put him straight. He'd negotiated deals with the toughest lawyers in the country, but standing up to his father was something he'd never been able to do. After all, why risk his anger when all he wanted was his approval? Ultimately, though, the thing with Yasmin was just about the sex. Things were bad at home, and Dan was looking for a distraction, that's all. And stuffing the crumpet, as his father would have said, fits the bill nicely. But Yasmin saw things differently. She got clingy, started talking about leaving her husband and marrying Dan. It was the last thing he wanted. He backed off, but she wasn't the sort of woman you could just dump with a no-hard-feelings hug. She threatened to go to HR, all hellfire and fury. "I'll tell them you've been harassing me," she said, "that you pressured me into sex." He was desperate. All Yasmin had to do was turn on the waterworks and everyone would believe her. With women, that's all it takes, he'd thought. Forget not making partner. Despite Axel's advances, S&M was a traditional firm. He'd get the boot for sure, and once word got out he'd sexually harassed a co-worker, it wouldn't just be a case of never working at a law firm again. He'd never earn a decent salary again either. No one wants to hire a guy that's going to cause trouble. He was already behind on his mortgage payments and up to his eyebrows in debt. But worse than that, after all these years, he'd finally begun to amount to something in his father's eyes. When he'd finally made partner at the Magic Circle firm, his old man had started talking about my son, the hotshot lawyer, to his friends on the golf course, and only recently he'd offered to propose Dan for membership to the exclusive club. At last, he'd earned the admiration he'd always craved. If he lost his job over a bit of skirt, he'd go back to being the loser his father always thought he was. He couldn't face the thought, but he had no idea how to get out of the mess he'd made. And then his wife had a blackout. The fugue had lasted an hour. Sarah was scared. She said she had no clue what had happened during what she called that lost time. Dan didn't know either, but it gave him an idea. He did his research. He made a plan. For history to repeat itself, he had to recreate the emotional conditions Sarah had experienced before the blackout and murder of her brother. Betrayal. A sense of injustice. A threat that needed eradicating. He left a trail. Photos of Yasmin on his laptop. A pair of her knickers at the back of the cupboard. Emails and faked phone calls for his wife to overhear. He hated making her suffer, but he told himself he was doing this for her as well as himself. She was so fragile. She'd never cope if they lost the house and everything he'd worked for. He didn't want to have to do it, but what choice did he have? Frankly, this was Yasmin's fault, not his. He made a big deal to Sarah about taking his new sushi knife back to the shop and how he was going to put it in the car. In the glove box, he said more than once, just in case she wasn't listening. The day her brother had been killed with a rock, her mother had told her off for throwing stones in the garden. "It's dangerous," she'd said. "You could really hurt someone." The night Yasmin Pejman was stabbed, Dan Harper echoed her words. "The knife's sharp. It could really hurt someone." Then he'd said he was off for drinks with some of his colleagues. He told her the name of the bar and when they'd be there. He was very specific. He'd let her know Yasmin would be there too. He'd planted a seed and watered it carefully. He wasn't surprised when his lover was murdered. After all, he'd set the whole thing up. The precedent was there. The death of Sarah's brother showed what she was capable of, even if she didn't know it. "Language is easy to manipulate," he thinks. The same thought he'd had when he'd been led into the interview room that first time. He'd always been good at reading people and pushing his agenda. Taking advantage of his wife's condition was no different. There was no way this would get traced back to Sarah, he'd thought. After all, there was no way to prove he and Yasmin had been seeing each other.
They'd been so careful. Which meant there was no motive, as far as anyone could tell, for his wife to kill her. It was the perfect crime. Though, as it turned out, his wife was less easy to control than he'd thought. And after Lily Abian was killed, he became terrified of what he'd unleashed. He stopped sleeping. His eating became erratic. He snapped constantly at his wife. The slightest thing would set him off. He couldn't help it. But there was no way back. It was all about damage limitation now. After Yasmin's death, he deleted the sexy pictures she'd sent him. He chucked the burner he'd bought at the beginning of their affair, extra pleased now that he had, since there'd be no call logs to link him to her. And of course, it wouldn't matter if anyone ever got hold of Yasmin's mobile. The silly cow had refused to get a prepaid device at the time, but at least she'd agreed never to call him by name in her texts or to tell anyone who she was screwing. "I could lose my job if word got out," he'd said. "All the other firms are well-known shagging shops, but S&M's different. It's big on traditional values." He knew she'd kept his identity secret, even from that sister she was so close to. But banging on about the importance of keeping their relationship under wraps had backfired in the end. It had given her a way to hurt him when he'd tried to call time on their affair, which is why he'd had to come up with his scheme. It was genius. No one would suspect his wife. And if, for any reason, they did, there was always an insanity plea. One way or the other, she'd be okay. And so would he. There was nothing to lose and everything to gain. But now, he's lost it all. Sarah, his job, his father's pride. And things were about to get a whole lot worse. Chapter 143. Bloomfield Villas, London, 2358. I was curled up in my usual spot on the sofa, nursing a big glass of Chilean Pinot Noir and listening to a recording of the Tehran Symphony Orchestra, an old anthology of Sufi poetry open on my lap. A key turned in the lock. I looked up with a smile. I knew who it was before he walked through the door.
"What are you doing still up, Hen?"
Duncan said, chucking his keys into the dish on the radiator cover, a steaming bowl of pasta in his other hand. "Waiting for you."
"You want to stop waiting?"
He swept my hair to the side as he bent down to kiss my neck.
"Stay with me,"
I said, my voice a whisper.
"You don't need me. You'll be all right."
A buzzing sound woke me up. Instinctively, I reached across the bed to the patch where Duncan should have been lying, cursing the phone for ending the dream. It was flashing on the nightstand. A text from Jack.
"We make a good team, you and me."
I touched my neck where Duncan had kissed me.
"You'll be all right," he'd said.
And for the first time since he died, I thought, maybe he's right. It won't be easy, but I'm going to be fine. We hope you've enjoyed our presentation of Nothing to Lose by Victoria Selman, performed by Karen Cass. Performance copyright 2018 by Brilliance Publishing, Inc. All rights reserved. For further information concerning this programme or other Brilliance audio titles, please call the following toll-free number: 1-800-222-3225. Or visit our website at www.brillianceaudio.com. No part of this recording may be played for an audience or reproduced in any form. It may not be streamed, downloaded, broadcast, or copied without written permission. Address all inquiries to Brilliance Audio, P.O. Box 887, Grand Haven, Michigan 49417.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.